For more than 35 years, researchers at the Cary Institute of Ecosystem Studies in Millbrook, New York, have been studying how interactions between acorns, rodents, ticks, predators, and climate shape Lyme disease risk in people. A new research paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences peer-reviewed journal details nine of the project's most surprising findings to date. And joining me today is Dr. Richard Ostfeld, a Cary Institute disease ecologist who co-directs the tick monitoring program and is a co-author of this paper. Welcome to Robin Hood Radio.
Thank you very much, Mike. I appreciate it.
I think an interesting way to start this would be to give us an overview of the mechanics of what's involved in a study as it leads up to actually publishing the research and findings so that people can understand them.
Yeah, sure. I'll try to make this interesting to the non-scientists in the audience. It's difficult. This is a project that's been running since 1991. And it involves a whole bunch of different organisms, animals, plants, microbes, out in the environment. And it involves estimating how many there are and what impacts they have on one another. So we do things like set out small metal box traps to census the small mammals like white-footed mice and chipmunks, shrews, squirrels, and the like. Sometimes those traps get raided by raccoons or bears, so we have to protect them against disturbance. We collect ticks in the environment, which involves dragging a piece of white cloth along pre-measured transects on the forest floor, and we collect them, count them. We then crush some of them to determine what they're infected with, whether it's the Lyme disease pathogen or one of several others. We collect acorns produced by the oak trees, as well as seeds produced by the other tree species in our environment. And then we have a weather station on the property of the Cary Institute that tells us how warm it is, how dry, how wet, how much rainfall, what the maximum and minimum temperatures and such are. And then we use statistical models over the course of this very long time series to let the data tell us what are the most important predictors of the bottom line, which is how many nymph stage black-legged ticks there are out in the environment, because that's the main risk factor to people of getting exposed to a tick-borne illness.
Now, how wide of an area do you do the research? Just on your campus, or do you go out to other areas when you're exploring this?
This project reports on a study that was done largely on the campus of the Cary Institute. So we have six sites within the 2,000-acre Cary Institute grounds. Each of them is about 5 acres in size, but we've done a lot of other research elsewhere in the Hudson Valley, but also in adjacent parts of Connecticut, New Jersey, and the like. So it's not entirely restricted to our local area. But this long-term study, you can only do pretty much in one spot if you're keeping it going for 35 years and collecting so much data per site.
At what point did you come to the conclusion that you had the information you needed to go ahead and publish a paper on this?
Yeah, it's a great question. When you're conducting a long-term study and you're collecting this pretty much the same data with a few variations, for 35 years, you have to decide when you update your publications. At what point do you think that you have something new to say? And that's a subjective decision. So we felt as though at the end of 2025 season, once we analyzed the data and we found very strong patterns, or when we didn't find a pattern at all, such as no relationship between deer and the abundance of ticks, when we had a high degree of statistical confidence in those results, we went ahead and did the update and put this together for this worldwide leading journal, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
Now, I know a lot of times when we think of Lyme disease, we associate it strictly with deer and deer ticks. And I learned from one of your associates that's not necessarily the case. However, the study that you've done, you talk about nine things that were rather more interesting than other things, we'll say. Do you want to talk about that part of the study?
For one thing, there's no such thing as a deer tick. It's a misnomer. That was a name given to this tick species, the black-legged tick, back in the 1980s when it was thought that a brand new tick had been discovered by scientists in southern New England. But it turned out a few years later that it was not a new tick. It was a particular population of a species of tick that had been described a couple hundred years ago. So there are rules of naming things in science, and by the rules, the previous established name, the black-legged tick, the scientific name is Ixodes scapularis. That's the one that's accepted. But by giving it what turned out to be a discredited name, the deer tick, that helped reinforce the notion that deer were the main player. Deer determine how many ticks there are. And so that leads me to one of the main surprises, which is that our data indicate that there was no association between the abundance of deer, which varied about fivefold over our 35-year study, and the abundance of the stage of the tick, the nymph stage of the black-legged tick, that is the most important in transmitting disease to people and to pets as well. So that was one surprise. On the other hand, we can predict how many black-legged ticks there are going to be in the environment based on how many white-footed mice there are the previous summer. And the essential reason for that is because mice are a really good host for the baby stages, the larval stage in the life cycle of the tick, so that when there are a lot of mice running around on the forest floor, then many of the newly hatched baby ticks are able to feed on mice and they survive really well, which is not the case when they try to feed on almost any other mammal or bird host that they attempt to feed on. They feed on lots of different animal species. And then furthermore, we can even predict how many mice there are going to be running around in the woods or coming into our basements or garages, by virtue of how many acorns are produced the previous fall. So if you put all that together, you find that almost 2 years in advance, based on acorn production, we can predict how many ticks and how many infected ticks there are going to be out in the environment where we may encounter them. Another surprise, and I'll leave you with this one, I guess, for now, is that there's it's sort of a conventional wisdom that cold snaps in the winter will kill off a whole bunch of the ticks. And so if we have a really, really cold winter, the next spring or summer, we should see a better than average year for Lyme disease, better meaning less exposure. Whereas if we have a warm winter, the conventional wisdom tells us that we should have a really bad year, lots and lots of ticks, lots of Lyme disease. And we found no support for that conventional wisdom, that hypothesis at all. We found no support for cold snaps or summer heat waves or any of those things affecting tick populations. And that's clearly because the ticks are able to escape those extreme conditions in the woods, in their environments, by seeking safe harbor under the leaf litter and in the soil and getting out of harm's way.
Now, you spoke about the mice and the acorns, the relationship between the amount of acorns versus the mice. Is there any impact from squirrels in this particular thing? When I think of acorns, I think of squirrels. Do they play into this at all?
They do, and we have included gray squirrels. We get a few red squirrels, a few flying squirrels, so a few different species of squirrel in our monitoring. They play a modest role. The squirrels are able to kill some of the ticks that attempt to feed on them, so they're not like the mice. They don't boost populations of ticks. And the squirrels are rather poor at passing on an infection to the ticks as well. So the squirrels don't boost the number of infected ticks in anything remotely like the way the mice do. We have found a modest response by squirrels to the availability of acorns because they too eat them, they store them. We can see them in our yards and in parks and the like, storing acorns. They come back and eat them later on, but sometimes they forget, or they get their cache of acorns pilfered by some other squirrel. And so sometimes those acorns germinate, they sprout, and squirrels do play a role in dispersing acorns and giving them a fighting chance at growing up so they can assist in forest regeneration. So their effect is very indirect. It's at a distance and with a long time lag. It's not immediate or close to immediate, direct and strong like the situation with white-footed mice. And chipmunks are sort of in between. They do have an effect. It's stronger than that of the squirrels, but not as powerful as that of the white-footed mice.
And what would you say about other warm-blooded creatures in the forest?
Many of them have a suppressive effect on tick abundance or tick infection, and this is underappreciated. So we're always looking for the culprit. Who's to blame for producing how many ticks there are and how many of them get infected? And we have a good culprit, the white-footed mouse, but we fail to appreciate that there are other animals that are out there protecting our health because they're killing ticks, usually in the process of grooming when the ticks try to feed on them. Or if they fail to kill the tick and the tick does feed on the host, then those animal hosts fail to infect them, which means that the tick, when it bites someone or something later on in its life, is not dangerous. It has nothing to transmit. So many of the hosts, things like raccoons, skunks, opossums, foxes, and a fair number of ground-dwelling birds that encounter ticks, actually reduce the number of ticks and reduce their infection rate. And so they're the unsung heroes of the forests. And the more diverse a community of animals we have, mammals and birds, the lower the risk of human exposure to tick-borne diseases. So protecting biodiversity is great for the environment, we know that. But what we've learned more recently is that it's also great for human health.
Mother Nature basically will help take care of some things in that case.
Absolutely.
How about your dogs and cats, your own pets? Can they get Lyme disease?
Dogs can. Dogs get symptoms of Lyme, including fever, including lethargy, including arthritis, swollen joints, and stiffness, similar to the way people do. To my knowledge, according to veterinarian colleagues, cats generally do not get signs or symptoms of Lyme disease. And most wildlife, at least so far as we can tell, have no obvious effect of being infected by these bacteria at all. So dogs and horses are the domesticated animals that are affected, do get disease symptoms similar to those of humans, but most critters out there do not. And we don't really understand why. I try to convince my immunologist colleagues or veterinarians to ask these questions in a scientific setting. So far, that hasn't worked, and we still don't really know why.
Well, as we might say, that's another study for another day, right?
Absolutely.
We have been talking with Dr. Richard Ostfeld. He is of the Cary Institute over in Millbrook, New York. He is an ecologist who co-directs the tick monitoring program. We've been talking about a recent paper that was written by he and his colleagues and published in the National Academy of Sciences peer review journal. And it's all about some of the new things they've learned about Lyme disease, and it dispels some of the myths that maybe have been believed for years. And presents a lot of new information. We thank you very much for talking with us about that today, Dr. Ostfeld.
It's been a great pleasure.
For more information or a copy of this research study, visit Cary Institute for Ecosystem Studies online at caryinstitute.org or Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences online at pnas.org.